Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Soon after she arrived in New York as cultural counselor to the French embassy in the United States in 1989, Annie Cohen-Solal met Leo Castelli at a dinner party. He immediately adopted her and promised to introduce her to the New York art world, of which he was the master. After he died in 1999, Cohen-Solal set out to learn the backstory of her friend's life and has recounted that story in detail in her new biography, Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. Annie Cohen-Solal is author of Painting American, The Rise of American Artists, Paris, 1867 to New York, 1948, and Sartre, A Life, and which has been translated into 16 languages. She is currently visiting arts professor at New York University Tisch School of the Arts. She spoke last night at the Wexner Center. We're pleased to have her with us today. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you so much to invite me here.
Leo Castelli is credited with revolutionizing the art gallery business and also introducing some of the most amazing artists of the 20th century. Can you tell us, you know, why is that? What did he revolutionize?
Yes. This country, the United States, is a country which behaved very differently from Europe towards the artist. In Europe, we admire creators and artists. In the United States, it was a different story. It's a Philistine country where the artist for a long time was rejected, considered as a second-rate citizen. They all complained about the fact that nobody respected them. So Castelli is a European. He's a Jew from Europe, who through persecutions and displacement arrived on the shores of this continent in 1941. He arrives in New York and he says the art scene was a desert. It was completely provincial. It was boring. So he sees the galleries, he sees the artists, and he notices that the artists are not making money, not being showed, not being respected the way they are in Europe. So for 16 years before he opens his own gallery, he opens it in 1957, he networks. He's a collector. He meets Jackson Pollock. He meets Bill de Kooning. He meets Clement Greenberg. He meets, you know, the big names. Mm-hmm. He meets the critics, the artists, and he mingles with them, and he creates his network. And when he opens his own gallery, it is not to show artists who exist, but to discover new artists. And the first one he discovers is Jasper Johns, who at the time is 26 years old, is painting in the studio where next to his friend Bob Rauschenberg, and they say we were painting for each other. Nobody was interested in our work.
The way he discovered Jasper Johns is quite a story, too.
It's beautiful.
Just by chance.
Yeah, Jasper Johns has one painting showed at the Jewish Museum. And Leo goes one Sunday, and he is mesmerized by one green square target. He said the color was mesmerizing, the theme, the target was mesmerizing, the fabric, which was wax mingled with color, was mesmerizing. Even the name, Jasper Johns, was completely... And he came back completely electrified by what he discovered, this epiphany. And he couldn't talk about anything else. And a few days later, he's taken to Bob Rauschenberg's studio to visit Rauschenberg's works, who's older than Jasper Johns and so on. And Rauschenberg says, would you like a drink? Yes, says Leo. Would you like a Coke? Yes, says Leo. Would you like ice in your Coke? Yes, says Leo. Well, I'll pick up the ice from my next-door neighbor, Jasper Johns, says Rauschenberg. So Leo says, Jasper Johns, can I come with you? And he is in front of the works of Jasper Johns, targets, numbers, maps, letters, everything. And he says to Jasper, can I show you? And Jasper says yes, and Leo goes. He doesn't even say goodbye. So when he opens the Jasper Johns show on the 20th of January, 1958, this is a riot. It's a masterstroke. It's a show which launches Jasper. It's on the cover of Art News. And Alfred Barr, the director of MoMA, comes for the opening and buys four paintings. And immediately this kid from South Carolina, who's 26 years old, becomes completely integrated into the Museum of Modern Art collection. So Leo Castelli launches Jasper Johns, and Jasper Johns launches Leo Castelli as a gallerist. And that's from that day on, Leo Castelli becomes the brilliant, the most genius gallerist. Why is a gallerist so important in the art world? Because artists exist everywhere. But unless they are carried, supported, promoted by critics, gallerists, collectors, they are not visible That's what Castelli did. He identified the artists, he identified the critic, he identified the collectors, he created for them a network of support, and you know, he paid them monthly.
I was going to say he actually literally took care of them.
Yeah, I mean, he gave them monthly stipends, so they didn't have to worry anymore. He created, he selected the collectors. He said, I am not selling a painting by Jasper Johns for $1,000 to whoever gives me a check. I am selecting the ones who are worse buying a Jasper Johns. And I'm not selling art to hang on the walls. I am placing works of my artists in collections that I choose myself. You know, it was brilliant. So within a few years, Castelli would create something completely new, which is a network of satellite galleries all over the United States, all over Europe, that nobody had done before. He's going to become the first global gallerist. He's going to become global. He's going to place the Jasper Johns paintings in Amsterdam, in London, in Columbus, in St. Louis, Missouri, in Los Angeles, you know, and he's going to make Bob Rauschenberg become the first American to win the Golden Lion in Venice at the Venice Biennale in 1964.
Yes.
It's very important. It's mm-hmm. the first time that an American is becoming legitimized by the Venice Biennale. So, and what, like one of the artists of Castelli, who's Jim Rosenquist, what he said one day was, Leo made Americans understand that we were not bums. Becoming part of Castelli's gallery made people understand that we were respectable citizens.
My guest is Annie Cohen-Solal. She is the biographer of Leo Castelli, the name of her biography. It's called Leo in a Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, in some ways, just to hear you talk about him makes me feel like he found one of the last places to be a pioneer in the United States. It, you know, they had the transit, you know, transatlantic railroad by then. You couldn't discover anything more about the country, but he discovered the art world.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. That's very, very true. He energized the art world. You mm-hmm. know, the art world existed, but it was not considered essential. There was a time in this country where the art world was legitimized. It was with President Roosevelt, the WPA program between 1933 and 1943. But, you know, usually in the United States, the state is not very interested in the art. As you know, you
right.
know, there's very little money with NEA, NEH.
Less and less with every year that goes by.
But Castelli, you know, also in his gallery, the gallery was an educational institution. You know, people like, for example, Rosalind Krauss, who is professor of art history now at Columbia. She was then a young student, a PhD student at Harvard. And she was, you know, coming to New York. She said, every time I went to Leo's gallery, it was a fascinating show, and I would write for Art Forum. And every time I came, I was fascinated because Leo was showing artists, and I trusted him because I trusted him the way I trust my professors. A professor is someone you trust. So basically, everything which came with his mark, with his label, mm-hmm. was worthy of attention. So it became something with prestige for collectors. And that's how he grabbed all the new money people, these new industrialists who came into the city and who were fighting to have Leo's artists.
They had to prove themselves to him, though. I thought there was a really interesting story about the fellow, I'm sure he was royalty in Italy, I think.
It's called Panza di Biumo?
Yes.
Yeah,
Panza.
It's a very interesting story. Leo is trying to sell Bob Rauschenberg's combines to MoMA. And Alfred Barr, as much as he loved Jasper Johns, is not crazy about Rauschenberg. So Leo is trying forcefully to have combines come into the collection of MoMA. But Alfred Barr is not interested. It's 59, 60, 61. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he gets a letter from a man. He says, I'm a collector in Italy, and I'd love to buy a Rauschenberg's combine. And I saw in the correspondent that Leo says, no, 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 we don't have combines to sell. So, you know, he says to MoMA, buy the combines, and he says to Panza, I don't have combines to sell at this very same time. Why? Because he was organizing his own system, saying, what is the best for my artist? It's a museum, this museum in New York, which is for me fabulous. So he was also testing the collectors. And he forced the collectors to go through a test, a few years test, see whether they would understand the work. You know, it's not a check of $1,000, which is worse. You know, it's just he was selecting them. It was really organizing, organizing a real network of people that he trained. And one of the people who was trained by Leo is somebody called Eli Broad in Los Angeles, who's the mega philanthropist today. And Eli Broad told me, he said, Leo Castelli educated me. I came to his gallery in Soho once a month just to have lunch with him because he told me what to buy and what to look and how to look at it. Mm-hmm. His gallery became a destination gallery. You know, it was, you will not believe every single person I interviewed, be an artist, a critic, a gallerist, a collector, they all feel that this man, trained them, educated them, because he behaved as if he were on a mission. He was not interested in money. He was not making money. He was not speculating at all. He was always almost bankrupt every month. What he would do, he would not, you know, he didn't get rich. He always lived in the same apartment. What he wanted is to bring people together in this great mission, which was the discovery of American art. I mean, when he showed Andy Warhol, for example. Mm-hmm. Andy Warhol, it was a dark period in the 60s, which was a social critic of the United States. You see, he got Jean-Paul Sartre to write about Andy Warhol in his magazine, Les Temps Modernes. When he got the first Jasper Johns, he got Leo Steinberg, who's a critic of the Renaissance, to write about Jasper Johns. So he really made incredible choices. Why? Because he wanted to bring American artists into the course of art history, which was European. So he created a genealogy for them. You know, he inserted them, he anchored them in what it was the most legitimizing at the time, which was European art. And thanks to him, American art stopped being provincial, became essential, became global, and became the most important art today to buy. He launched, you know, the market on American art. Before him, it didn't exist. Absolutely not. You know, so this country owes too much, so much to Leo Castelli, so much that, you know, the legacy is so big that I'm even now creating a Leo Castelli Institute to develop all the elements that he changed in this country. Listen, Anne, when I was at the French embassy and I came to this country knowing very little of this country, I was told that President Reagan never went into the Museum of Modern Art. You know, I was surprised, you know, that a politician is not interested in art. But thanks to Leo Castelli, now the paintings of Jasper Johns and of Rauschenberg are on the walls of the White House. The first painting that President Obama put on the walls of the White House are the ones of Leo Castelli's artists. And when Rauschenberg died, there was a funeral service 2 years ago at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And who came to speak about him? President Clinton. You know, I mean, it's a big change of this country where there was a complete discrepancy between politics and art and culture. You know, I think that coming together shows that Castelli brought from Europe a lot of these models. We do respect people who create symbolic value. You know, we don't only respect bankers, you know, or pioneers or macho men. You know, we do respect people who create. And Castelli, I want to show that although he was fiercely American and pro-American and always very, you know, very smiling and energetic and so on, his history was much more complex than what he, you know. That's why we put this metaphor photo on the cover of the book, Leo Castelli coming out of a photo of Leo Castelli. Yes. You see here?
Yes.
Because he always, when I first met him, he was charming and funny and social and superficial. But behind his miss of himself, his image of himself, there was a much more complex story. And Leo Castelli comes out from the Renaissance, Italy. Okay.
We're going to have to take a break right now.
Sure, sure.
We'll be back in a minute. If you'd like to join the conversation, my guest is Annie Cohen-Solal. She is author of Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
In just over a month, voters elect a new House of Representatives and a third of the U.S. Senate. If there's a Republican tide, is repeal of health care a real prospect? What happens to tax cuts and why control of state legislatures is so important this year? I'm Neil Conan. What's at stake in these midterm elections? NPR's Ron Elving joins us, plus the opinion page. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 49 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021 this morning. Clouds with a chance of rain today and a high of 58. A few clouds tonight, also a slight chance of rain and a low of 45.
Support for WOSU comes from the John Glenn School of Public Affairs, presenting author and political strategist Donna Brazil, November 15th at the Ohio Union. The event is open to the public, but filling quickly. More at glenn.osu.edu.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the famed gallerist Leo Castelli with his biographer Annie Cohen Solal. The name of the book, Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation, you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, we have some links for you there if you want to learn more about Leo Castelli. And you can also comment there as well. There's so much to talk about with him. I don't think we're going to have enough time. But let's talk about his background, because you mentioned the metaphor on the cover of the book. He's Leo Castelli walking out from behind a large, obviously, photograph of himself. And you talk about his, maybe kind of a little bit of the mask he wore. But he really was a very nice guy in many ways, but it kind of masked his background and, mm-hmm. and the sadness and the tragedy of his background. Can you mm-hmm. give us a little synopsis? I know you spent almost half the book on it.
So. No, it's true. I mean, you know, I first met him at a dinner, and he looked at me. I had arrived to take my position representing French culture in the United States, and I was dressed with, you know, long gloves and a transparent skirt on a Friday night, you know. He looked at me and he said, "You don't look like your predecessors. They were all gray men in gray suit with gray ideas and dressed like as you are. You're going to take New York City by storm. Tomorrow I have a show at the gallery. I'm opening a show for Roy. You come to the gallery, you stay for the dinner, and I'll teach you American art." And honestly, this way to welcome me was unbelievable, but it was more than that, because Leo did really do the job. He gave me books. He took me to openings. He invited me to people. He gave me his network. I mean, really, mm-hmm. he gave me Jasper John's phone number. He really taught me. It was all about education. It was all about generosity. It was not for himself. It was for me to discover what he praised the most, which was American artists. But he would talk a lot. He would talk a lot about himself. And I had a feeling that he would talk too much. And sometimes I was even exasperated by the way he would talk about himself. You know, this mechanic way that people have to talk, and you feel, but what is he hiding?
He's so much so that what's not being said.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was talking, but he was not saying anything. It was mechanical. So when I started to work on his trajectory in his life and his past, I tried to break this mask that he had created for himself, and I discovered that his life was so much more complex and so much more dramatic. You know, he made it look like a play by Feydeau or Courteline or Marivaux, but like a comedy. But his life was a tragedy, like a Shakespearean tragedy. Mm-hmm. And it carries over all the pains and all the traumas of the Jews of Europe. It carries also all the genius of the Jews of Europe. It's because the Jews were in this situation that they created this talent. And it's because of that that Leo was in between the field of money and the field of art. And in fact, I brought to the studio today his great nephew, who's called Paul Reiter, who invited me here in Columbus, Ohio. He's professor at the university. And Paul has been one of the very unique family members to help me track down the truth of Leo Castelli, Leo Kraus, he was born Leo Kraus in Trieste in 1909, and helped me discover the real story of the family.
Describe Trieste, though. It's a very unusual place.
Trieste, when Leo Castelli was born, is a harbor. It's like 1 hour away from Venice on the Adriatic Sea. And when Leo was born there, it was the harbor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So it was a very rich city, very open. And then there was the World War I, 1914-1918. And at the time, Leo and his family went to the capital of the empire, which was Vienna. And then the empire was dismantled. You know, it was this many, many nationalities and so on. So the empire was dismantled. And at the end of the war, Trieste became part of the Kingdom of Italy. So Leo is 11 years old. He comes back to his city. He comes back to his house. But it's not the same country. It's not the same language. It's not the same currency. It's not the same past. And he comes back to a different world. So all his life is bits and pieces like that. You know, Trieste is really a town which is a seismograph of Europe, of all the traumas of Europe. And in the first decade of the 20th century, the city of Trieste brought out, engendered three different things. It engendered the Manifesto of Futurism. It engendered this extraordinary novel, Ulysses, by James Joyce, who lived in Trieste.
Right.
And it engendered Leo Castelli.
That's when they had to change their name. When they returned and it was in Italy, now they were forced to change their name.
Because Mussolini wanted the Jews to have Italian names, so they took the name of the mother, who came from Tuscany, from a family of people who were selling paper to the artists in the Renaissance. You know, Leo once told me one thing, just like that, you know, flirtatiously and so on. He said, you should go to the village called Monte San Savino near Arezzo to see whether you find graves of my ancestors in the cemetery. That was said, you know, without any intention, you know, forced intention, just like that. Mm-hmm. And I went and I found an amazing story. I mean, the Jews who came from Spain after 1492 and who arrived then, who were trading money and trading paper. And I discovered that exactly what his ancestors were doing. They were selling paper to the artists, the same way he was doing in New York in 1960. You know?
It's interesting the way the Jews were treated throughout, you know, the early history. They were allowed to make a lot of money and to do their trading, but they were kept in
ghettos,
mm-hmm. very small.
Yeah.
An interesting thing. But by the time Leo was growing up, they were very wealthy, very well-to-do.
Yeah, because, you know, Trieste was a different story.
Right.
You know, I think a lot in the art world and so on has to do with the cleavage between Catholic countries and Protestant countries. In Italy, it was around the pontifical state. Mm-hmm. And in Trieste, they were welcomed by the Empress Marie Theresa, who was very welcoming to Jews, and Franz Josef, the emperor of the Habsburgian Empire, was so great with Jews that he was even called the Der Kaiser Juden, you know, the emperor for the Jews. So, you know, there were very different conditions for Jews to be living under, you know, whether in Catholic or Protestant countries. And definitely the Austro-Hungarian Empire welcomed them. You know, Vienna was, I mean, absolutely full of, you know, Jewish medical doctors and creators and Karl Kraus and writers and, you know, and that's where Leo belongs. I mean, really, he belonged to this kind of milieu.
614-292-8513 if you would like to speak with author Annie Cohen-Solal. She is the author of Leo in His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. Welcome to the show, Patty. You're on the air.
Oh, and this is a wonderful topic and is pertinent within my own life. So I had two questions for you. The first is there a contemporary of his now, someone doing similar work? Because I'm an artist. And an art teacher and marketing my own stuff, but I'm not aware of anyone doing such good work currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important question. You're right. I mean, yes, you feel lonely. You feel nobody's behind you. Yeah, I completely understand. I mean, Patty, your name is Patty, right?
Yes. Yes.
Patty, you know, there are some wonderful gallerists who follow up on the tradition of Leo Castelli, like, I would say, Marion Goodman in New York. She does exactly the same thing. She respects the artists. She goes to them. She supports them. There's also somebody called Tony Shafrazi in New York, whom the people I know, you know, there are a few of them. A lot of the other gallerists are speculators, you know. They're not that interested in artists. They're interested in collectors. They're interested in making money, you know. So Castelli was an artist gallery. But, for example, Larry Gagosian, who was close to Castelli, became a collector's gallerist. You know, he's selecting the richest collectors in the world. You know, but for artist gallerists, I would suggest Marion Goodman and Tony Shafrazi. You know, and if you need me, you can write to me on my website, annicoinsola.com.
Okay,
I'll help you.
That would be wonderful. And the Tonisha person, how did you say the last name?
Shafrazi, Shafrazi. But write to me on my website. I'll be in touch.
Okay.
Patty, I'll be happy to help.
Wonderful. My second question, and my own work has reflected on this, from advice given from a really wonderful art history professor. I went through Columbus College of Art and Design, and it was a woman professor, and one of the things she said is, if you want to really know what happened in history, usually the written history is written by those who won at the time, whoever the rulers were, mm-hmm. and much of what really happened is not represented in the art. Mm-hmm. And depending on the artist at the time and what they were allowed to comment on, it may be hidden in symbols. They may have done painting, sculpture, music, tapestries, and mm-hmm. really tell you what happened. And she's spoken in my head to me daily on this one, because one of the things she said was, it may be up to those of you in this room, and at the time I was sitting in a room of art students, about 25 of us, and she said, it may be up to you to tell future generations what was really happening.
This is a wonderful testimony. I love what you just said. It's so beautiful. You're exactly putting the accent on what Leo was interested in. You know, you're describing history being described by powerful men, you know, by power. And Leo was saying that the artist has as much to say about a time as the general, you know, or a politician. And I think that's a reason why we all think that we should approach history through art history. And, you know, artists have to be visible. You know, I worked on Jean-Paul Sartre, who was interested in the function of the intellectual in society. I'm interested in Leo Castelli because he was interested in the function of the artist in society. And he made American artists visible and essential to American life and American culture. And I think what you're just saying is so important. That's true. He empowered the artist, you see? And that's exactly what we want to develop as his legacy. We're exactly on the same wavelength, Patty. I'm delighted that you called.
Thank you,
well,
Patty.
Well, I would love to share some of what I've been working on with you, because I've been doing a lot of work on recording the history that's unfolded around me, and with not only pieces that I've enjoyed making, but some that are things that I thought was so important that I would want people forevermore to know about this.
Mm-hmm. Terrific.
And I very much appreciate getting to speak with you.
Thank you.
Patty, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Take care. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you would like to join the conversation. His relationship with the artists that he represented, and even artists that he didn't represent, he really liked to hang out with them. He said the point was to be with these people, to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
What does he mean by live their lives? He obviously loved them and loved being around them.
Yeah, you know, before he opened the gallery, mm-hmm. he was constantly, you know, he had a house in East Hampton where Bill de Kooning and his wife were spending two summers, for example. And Leo said the artists were my heroes. You know, he really worshipped them. So what he felt is that they were, you know, living in much more a bigger authenticity. They were much more authentic. They were much more lively. They were much more than the banker next door, you know. He felt that these people were carrying the truth of the country. He wanted to deliver the message. You know, that's what he meant. But I would love, you know, to have, this man who's sitting next to me.
Paul Reiter.
Yes, yeah, to say what he feels about.
Paul is with us. He's an OSU Associate Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Annie insists. But it is interesting, Paul. Leo Castelli was your
great-uncle.
Great-uncle, that's right. And you helped Annie, you know, with photos and some of the research and that sort of a thing. What does the family think of the story of his life? Because it's the story of your life.
Well, yeah, the story of my family.
Mm-hmm.
and it's hard to say what everyone thinks.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't spoken to some family members about this. I have the sense through Annie that there's a lot of excitement. I know my father, who also worked quite intimately with Annie and provided her with materials and wrote a little essay mm-hmm. on his childhood experiences, which Annie inserted into the book
mm-hmm.
and under the title Yellow Star. I know that he was.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
He was greatly moved by this, and you know, it's touching to see your family history out there, especially such a difficult family history. This is, to a large extent, the history of the family trying to survive in incredibly difficult circumstances.
And let me tell what happened.
He moved away.
Okay, the father mm-hmm. of Paul, I mean Robert Reiter, was 8 years old. He was raised by his parents in Budapest during the war. The mother converted to Catholicism, so he was raised as a Catholic kid, although the family was Jewish. And he survived during the siege of Budapest. His father was away, his mother, in terrible conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo Castelli, the brother, Leo, who's in the United States, arrives as an American soldier one day in Budapest and finds his sister and his nephew that he hasn't seen for 10 years. And he says, "What happened to my parents, to our parents?" And this is a scene which Robert Reiter gave me, told me, you know, which is breathtaking. And nobody around Leo Castelli knew about that story. Nobody. Nobody. He told nobody. So it's basically Leo as an American soldier arriving and discovering from his sister that the parents, how the parents have died. And I could not believe, nobody can believe it. And in fact, the parents, their parents, have spent 2 weeks locked in a closet in the city of Budapest. They were 75 years old and they had nothing to eat. They had to cross the Danube, I mean, swimming. The mother is drowned and the father is amputated and he has no grave. So this is a story of the parents of Leo Castelli, the most brilliant guitarist in the world. And when he noticed that from his sister and Paul's father in Budapest in 1945, and that's, I think, the most dramatic moment of the book, which is also
yes.
something that nobody expected to hear from this cheerful man, you know, elegant man, you know. So now the story takes another dimension. Also, Leo never spoke openly about being Jewish. Even his own son said, "My father never told me that I was Jewish." So we get to another dimension, which is how much should one say about his past? What are we to judge? And it gave me a very, I'm a scientist, so I'm not judging. I'm just giving facts, you know. But I felt that Castelli became even more interesting to me. The fact that he had managed to overcome, you know, that pains, that trauma, and created for himself a completely new persona, an American persona living in the present, in the future, not in the past, you know, not whiner. He was not a whiner.
Mm-hmm.
And I respected him immensely. You know, he decided that, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's so you get into the Leo with Leo, you know, the very intimate moment. So I'm so grateful that the family, you know, I mean, led me to understand that without even trying to hide it, you know,
mm-hmm.
saying, you know, we shouldn't, it's a taboo, we shouldn't talk. No, I mean, it's much more beautiful to be telling the truth and to get to understand what a human being does, you know, with his own trauma.
We have to take another break. My guest is Annie Cohen-Salal. She is author of Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Paul Ryder is still in the studio, and he'll be here when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're a continuous listener to WOSU, so be a continuous supporter by becoming a sustaining member today. As a sustaining member, your gift automatically renews, saving you and WOSU time and money. Give $20, $50, or $100 a month, and your sustaining membership will also help to keep on-air fundraising to a minimum. To become a sustaining member, call 1-866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour 2 of the program will be here, and we'll talk about creative education for our children with author and educator Mimi Chenfeld. Join us at 11 for that discussion.
Support for WOSU comes from Thurber House, presenting Evenings with Authors guest James L. Swanson, telling the story of Lincoln's funeral train in Bloody Crimes, Tuesday, October 12th at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
And in public radio, we depend on listener feedback. We want to hear from you. Go to wosu.org/survey. There you can sign up and send us your thoughts. And it's 50 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:42 this morning. Clouds today with a chance of rain off and on throughout the day, a high of 58. A few clouds tonight and a chance of rain, a low of 45 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Annie Cohen-Salal. She is the author of Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. He is the great gallerist, kind of changed the world of the art gallery in New York City and around the world, really, back in the 50s and the 60s. If you have a question or comment for Annie, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And also with us, Paul Ryder. He is an OSU Associate Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature. But he is also the grandnephew of Leo Castelli and helped with some of the research on the book. Paul, what did you learn from reading the book?
I learned quite a bit. I am certainly no expert in the New York art world of the 1960s, and I didn't understand the magnitude of Leo's accomplishment until I read the book and encountered Annie's very persuasive argument that she spelled out earlier in the program about how he essentially changed how artists were perceived in this country. And in part, I have to say, my image of him was probably clouded by his position in the family and this sense that Leo was someone who drifted through life rather than worked hard and fell into his success, used certain natural attributes, his charm, rather than some kind of systematic method, and that his success, therefore, was to a large extent a social success more than anything else. That was the perception of him and the family. Mm-hmm. As we hear in the book, he didn't really get going as a gallerist until age 50.
Right.
His sister married a serious stockbroker who was sort of like her father. Leo's younger brother, George, who's still alive, was a psychiatrist, went right to medical school, graduated medical school in 1938 or something like that in Milan. And Leo, what did Leo do?
He got a law degree. I mean, he was well educated.
He was very well read. But he had a kind of sinecure position in his father-in-law's businesses.
He married a rich woman. He married a rich woman. Yeah.
And so even though I like to think that I wasn't totally taken in by some of this talk, by this talk, which came in large part from my grandfather, who had a difficult relationship with Leo. I have to say that it probably did affect me, and reading the book was enlightening. And then I also learned quite a bit as a result of Annie's tremendous researches about the family history. Annie not only talked to Giorgio and another relative who lives in Italy, Piero, people who are rather old. Giorgio's 90; he's going to be 99 next year, and she recorded these histories that were in danger, really, of being lost. But she also did enormous an effort into archival research and found documents pertaining to the family's business activities, was able to establish to a certainty a rumor that had been in the family that I had never quite trusted about a Castelli, Aaron Castelli, winning a lottery and this transforming the family situation. So all of this was interesting and enlightening. I mean, who is not interested in their family? It's a fascinating thing to read about.
Annie, you interviewed Leo Castelli twice before he died in 1999. Mm-hmm. Did you do that with the intent of writing a book like this?
Yeah.
Do you think he wanted you to write a book like this?
It's a very, very interesting question. I don't know why I interviewed him. I needed to get his testimony about what was MoMA, what was the Museum of Modern Art when you arrived in New York, Leo? What was it? And he said, it was an encyclopedia of European art that no European country could do at the time, because Europe was at war when I was living in Europe. He said, you know, and he started to, and I don't know what I, because, you know, he had an official biographer, somebody who never wrote his biography, an American woman, an American mm-hmm. critic. She never did his biography. So he had an official person. And it's much after he passed away. I had written my book on American artists and showed it to him just before he passed away, and it's dedicated to him, for Leo, who taught me American art, you know. But then everybody told me, but you have to go on. It's the continuation of the first book. And I'm so happy I did it because, you know, I had the intuition that behind this opaque image of this, you know, frivolous socialite, there was a story. And it's, you know, now what I hear, the book has spread so much, you have no idea. It's been out for 4 months. Mm-hmm. And every single day I have, like, you know, tons of new testimonies mm-hmm. of people who say it's a legend of Leo. We changed our life. You know, I have letters from Algeria, letters from everywhere, who people want to do, first of all, an institute, but they also want to do a play. They want to do a miniseries on TV. They want to do, you know.
I want to cast the movie.
Really? Wonderful. Why? I mean, I'll come back to Columbus with you, Anne. I'd love
it's
to do
it. One of my hobbies.
Really? Oh,
no.
It's a joke.
It's for fun.
But
I
don't you think there's something very romantic in this? Or, you know, it's a saga. Don't you think it's a saga?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you made it a saga, though. A lot of people would just go back to a certain point. But you said that he and his wife too, mm-hmm. His first wife, mm-hmm. he had three.
Ileana. Yeah, he had three.
Ileana, the wealthy woman that he married when she was just 18 years old.
Yeah.
That they brought with them their European values. Mm-hmm. I mean, but that goes much farther back than just his adult life and his education and that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
It's almost in the blood.
Yes. You know, imagine that the Jews were forced to work in money. They were not allowed to be owners of their own places. So, I mean, I think the conditions of life, the social conditions of life determine, you know, I mean, what you're going to do. So, why did the ancestors of Castelli, for example, were Francophiles? Why? Because when they lived in Tuscany, they lived with, you know, they were put in a ghetto, first of all, in this city. And then came Napoleon Bonaparte invading Tuscany in 1790. And Napoleon Bonaparte protected the Jews because he was a modernist. So, you know, so just to explain, why were they Francophiles? Because they knew from, you know, the family told the grandchildren, who told the grandchildren that it was the French who protected them. You know, there's so many things. Why were they? So, I mean, for me, the memory, the family memory is essential. And I think that you know, in the United States, you live in the present and in the future. But I come from a continent where the past is very important. And you do not understand Leo Castelli if you do not get all the different stratas of the cultures that he experimented and that his family experimented.
Someone remarked, one of the book critics somewhere in some of the gazillion articles I read to prepare, that now I just lost my train of thought.
So it was one of these articles. They said, if you expect, I know what you're going to say, if you expect to read gossips on the art world,
this is
not the book. You get you get more than the somebody, you know, a lot of people couldn't take this first part of the book, you know, because they expected, you know, there's a Leo that you know. Everybody knows the Leo Castelli of the 60s.
They wanted to get to the juice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a Leo that everybody knew. There's a Leo that people hardly knew, the Leo number two, and there's the Leo number one that nobody knew, even the close family. So that's what I try to intertwine. You know, the first Leo was apolitical. He was living out of his wife's money. He was not very sympathetic. He was a kind of... The second Leo is the Leo in metamorphosis he's getting, and the third Leo is... You know, the genius of the art world, the leader.
I remember what I was going to say. Now, there were some remarks about how a French woman writing about an American gallerist who, you know, brought out American art the way he did. It was kind of a turnaround. A lot of people think the French kind of look at American art and Americans in general and, you know, don't think much of it. But I thought that was kind of interesting that anyone even brought it up. It didn't occur to me till I read it. Have you gotten any sense about, you know, about that and how odd it is? Because it didn't feel odd to me that you were writing about him.
I think there was something unpleasant about saying that I was French.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of a defensive gesture. Why? I mean, I never felt that. I am somebody who is a citizen of the world, as was Leo. I admire American art. And because I am European and because I speak many languages like Leo's, I was able to approach all the worlds that made him who he was better than an American who doesn't know anything. So I think it gave me an asset instead of being a handicap. I felt it was a note which was very unpleasant and even at the border of being xenophobic.
Yeah.
You know, don't you agree?
It just kind of popped out of this review, and I went,
yeah, yeah.
I
agree
surprised.
With you. I think it's a xenophobic. It's a defensive thing. You know, why? You know, I've done my job, and if I made a mistake, let me know. But why, by being French, I'm not allowed to write about that? I think it's a very narrow-minded, old-fashioned, passéist, whatever we want me to tell you, attitude. Don't you think, Paul? Did you remember that?
Strange. I can't remember. It might have been.
Yeah, it was.
I might have been New York Times.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you say? Did
Solomon.
You remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It must have been that one. Yeah. She had. It was a rough review anyway. But it was. But that must have been. But probably been the one it came from. We have an email from a listener. Did Leo Castelli have anything to do with the Pace Gallery, which actually had a branch here in Columbus until about 25 years ago?
Yes. It's Arne Glimcher whom I interviewed and who's actually not. And Arne Glimcher, who's a friend and who's a wonderful man, and I was introduced to him by Leo, is someone who said that Leo never helped him. He was not part of Leo's satellite galleries. And even at a certain time, they became rivals. Why? Arne is a very good gallerist, a very good businessman, even a very good producer. And one day when Leo was an old man, what happened is that one of the paintings of Jasper Johns, Leo's favorite artist, which was called Three Flags, which was owned by a family called the Tremaines, was sold and has been sold to the Whitney Museum for a huge amount of money, which was $1 million. And this deal was done by Arne Glimcher, and Leo never heard about it unless it was over. So that brought them in rivalry. So it's something that was very tough on Leo Castelli, who was an old man and who felt that he had been betrayed because he had not been involved in the reselling of one of the most beautiful pieces of one of his most important artists. But that deal was done by Arne Glimcher from the Tremaines to the Whitney. And I did, and very often they were opposed in the press. So it's one example of one gallery who is doing extremely well. You know, they celebrate their 50th anniversary, and Arne Glimcher is a certainly incredible artist, but he was not part of Leo's network. I mean, they were actually rivals, and that means a lot. I mean, that means that Glimcher was also a very strong and powerful dealer.
The galleries, they're still out there. You can go to New York City right now. I mean, there's a gallery. You can go. They have a website.
Yeah, that's something else.
What does it represent now?
Yeah, I'll tell you. So Leo had three wives. The first wife, Ileana, he was married with her for 20 years, and she opened her own gallery, the Ileana Zonaben Gallery. She passed away 2 years ago. Second wife, Twenty, a French woman, she married for 25 years. She passed away, and she had a son with him called Jean-Christophe. The daughter with Ileana being Nina Sundahl, who is also a curator. And when Leo was old, very old, he met a young Italian critic called Barbara Bertozzi, who married him 4 years before he passed away and made him close the gallery. And then she opened a gallery on her own, very small, that she called the Leo Castelli Gallery, okay. And where she does good shows, but it has nothing to do with the spirit of Leo Castelli that we're talking about.
We are out of time. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining us, Annie.
Thank you. I know that's very exciting. And thank you so much for including
Paul Reiter, too.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So I'll come back to you for the movie, right?
I hope so. Okay. I hope so, definitely. I can't wait to see it. The book is Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. It's by Annie Cohen-Solal. She was here last night to speak at the Wexner, and we're glad she could join us today in the studio. Thanks again. That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.